Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Matt Katz from WNYC in for Melissa Harris-Perry this week, and this is The Takeaway. It's the season of togetherness, but we're starting in Washington, D.C., so forget all that for now.
I cannot vote to continue with this piece of legislation. I just can't. I've tried everything humanly possible. I can't get there.
From the very start, West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin's main concern over the Build Back Better bill was its supposedly mammoth price tag. That was slowly pared down on account of his wishes.
Bernie started at $6 trillion, then they went to $3.5 trillion, down to $2.2 from the House side, even at $1.75. The thing that never changed was basically the same amount of things that they're trying to accomplish by just changing the amount of time that we can depend on them.
His stated economic concerns included inflation and its impact on West Virginians. But of course, Manchin has a large family connection to fossil fuels, and maybe the large-scale climate change action in this bill is an underlying reason for his departure. That said, all this comes after months of negotiations with Democratic leaders in the White House and Congress. Nearly a quarter of President Biden's first term has been spent on this.
Every day and every minute of every day, I've been working on this, meeting with whether it be the president, President Biden, whether it be Majority Leader Schumer and his staff, whether it be with Nancy Pelosi, all of my colleagues, I mean, from all different spectrums of the political spectrum, if you will, from the right to the left.
After his public execution of the current Build Back Better plan on Fox News, the White House wrote a blistering statement effectively questioning Manchin's word. Between Joe Manchin's tension with the White House,
Joe Manchin's
position opposite progressive Democrats,
Joe Manchin's
rejection of climate policy,
Joe Manchin, you know by now,
Joe Manchin this, Joe Manchin that, it might not surprise you that much of the national media is talking a lot about the West Virginia senator.
On that stunning announcement.
Getting a lot of reaction from liberal media.
What it was that changed for him to now say definitively no.
Manchin has said no a lot during the first year of the Biden administration, from a nominee for budget director to a voting rights bill that Democrats see as the best way to literally save democracy. Why? That's what we're asking today on The Takeaway.
I just can't. I've tried everything humanly possible. I can't get there.
With me now is Ken Ward Jr., co-founder of Mountain State Spotlight and distinguished local reporting fellow with ProPublica. Ken, welcome.
Thank you.
Also here is Evan Osnos, author, CNN contributor, and staff writer for The New Yorker. Evan, welcome.
Thanks, Matt.
All right, Ken. So you've been covering West Virginia for a long time. What makes a politician want to tank his own party's foundational legislative agenda?
Well, I really think that despite the massive search for some answer on this from the national political media, that it's not really that complicated. The politics of it for Joe Manchin aren't. West Virginia has become a deep red state. Republican operatives who've masterfully moved what was a reliably Democratic state into the GOP column are lying in wait for Senator Manchin. They'd love to have his seat, and they're on the alert for anything they can point to that can be used to frame him as being in league with the Democrats, with President Biden, or even worse, Speaker Pelosi. Congressman Alex Mooney, who represents West Virginia, labeling this bill as a socialist spending spree. Senator Capito calls it reckless. I think that the politics are pretty simple. If, you know, Senator Manchin's idol, the late Senator Robert C. Byrd, used to say, run scared or don't run. Senator Manchin clearly is very worried about allowing the Republicans to position him as being some sort of leftist in league with folks that are pushing all sorts of socialist priorities.
That's the state of play in West Virginia. Evan, nationally, the reporting on this makes Manchin look like the sole barrier to the bill's passage. Is that really the case? Is he really President Manchin, or would have there might have been other obstacles to this getting this bill through if Manchin wasn't the one, you know, out front on it?
Right. That's an important point, actually. I mean, there are other Democrats who are, in a sense, sort of hiding in Manchin's skirts a bit. I mean, they are happy to let him go out and take the heat and kind of, you know, if to mix metaphors, kind of be the blocker who's going out ahead and kind of taking all of this public attention. But there are other moderate Democratic senators who have reservations about the bill. And because he's kind of willing and able to go out and do this, he ends up absorbing a lot of the flack. But he's not alone, actually, in his objections.
Who are the other potential obstacles? Who's hiding in his skirts, as you say?
We know Kyrsten Sinema, obviously, senator who has also expressed her reservations. But then there are others, and they don't always announce themselves by name, because for precisely this reason, which is that you end up taking a huge amount of political flack. I think, look, as Ken said so well, the truth is that everybody is dealing with their own local political reality. And in Joe Manchin's case, the politics in West Virginia make it very hard for him to go along with progressive priorities. And there are other states where that's also the case, where you have essentially a red electorate, whether we're talking about Wyoming or you're talking about West Virginia. Those are places where, as you know, John Tester once put it to me, he said, you have to make sure when you're a blue senator from a red state that you don't look as if you've gone Washington. And so a lot of what Joe Manchin has to do is to project that image as forcefully as possible.
Evan, you wrote a great profile of Manchin in The New Yorker. You wrote a book on Joe Biden. And I'm just wondering if there was anything Biden, maybe with help from Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, could have done to prevent this. Could Manchin have been persuaded? Could he still maybe be persuaded by a little something something for West Virginia? You know, a few billion for new schools, just some like bacon he could have brought home that would have protected him politically? Could that have worked, Evan? Is that possible?
Well, I think people have been looking for a way that Joe Biden could pick the lock, you know, in some kind of the old fashioned political way would be all of a sudden you award West Virginia a big military installation, or you give the state where the senator who's giving you trouble something that he needs. And actually, part of the complexity of Joe Manchin is that he's basically saying, no, I'm not going to go for it that way. And I think they have tried various versions of that. But the truth is that and this is really where Ken hits the nail on the head, is that there is this fundamental political environment in which Joe Manchin is operating in, where he gets up every day and he says, how do I make sure that I don't look like I'm too much of a friend to Joe Biden, the Democratic president? Which is ironic, too, because after all, Joe Biden and Joe Manchin have a lot in common. These are both two Catholic Joes in their 70s. I mean, they are both moderates by nature. They're glad-handers. They like to do politics. And they actually have a pretty good relationship fundamentally. I mean, the joke is it's the Joe-mance. But I think even though you see it now breaking down over this moment, you also pick up, and this is important, that each one of them has said in the last couple of days, this is not personal between the two of us. There may be a path forward. And you're going to continue to see them try to do something, even though this bill has been kind of left on the cutting room floor by Manchin's decision.
Yeah. Ken, Manchin said on Fox, if I can't go back home and explain it, I can't vote for it. But you have a story out today, actually, that you published in partnership with ProPublica about a particular community in West Virginia that would have been greatly helped by the Build Back Better legislation that Manchin just killed. Can you tell me a little bit about that story and how Manchin's ties to fossil fuels are kind of lurking in the background here?
Sure. We published Mountain State Spotlight in ProPublica this morning, a piece about the community of Institute, West Virginia. It's one of only two census tracts in the state of West Virginia that's majority Black. It's a historically Black community with a historically Black college. It's also home to what ProPublica's analysis of toxic air pollution shows is one of the most dangerous chemical plants in the country. It's part of a larger project with ProPublica examining the failure of our environmental regulatory system to protect us from the risks of cancer from toxic air pollution. And we found, among other things, that Black communities in this country face twice the cancer risk from toxic air pollution. And Institute West Virginia is one of those. And the Black community of Institute has faced 40 years of controversy and fighting with the plant there to try to make the place safer and reduce the risks. And interestingly, the Build Back Better bill had a bunch of money for environmental justice priorities, for cleaning up legacy pollution, for better monitoring of pollution, for better housing and jobs in these communities. And so, like, one of the most interesting things that Senator Manchin said in his statement opposing the bill was when he was critical of his fellow Democrats, saying they are determined to dramatically reshape our society. And Senator Manchin's right about that. This kind of a bill is looking at dealing with structural inequities in our country, structural racism in our country, and providing government resources and government programs to try to change those things and reduce those structural inequities. And for a place like West Virginia, you know, part of the structural inequity here is West Virginia is not really a massively poor state. It's actually a really wealthy state. It's just that most of the wealth from the natural resources, from the coal and the natural gas and the production of steel and chemicals, have gone someplace else. So West Virginia ends up 50th on too many lists of bad things and first on too many lists of bad things. And so, you know, this bill included lots of other things that would help a place like West Virginia: child tax credits, child care affordability, paid family leave, programs to fight child hunger, and most importantly, clean energy investments that are especially important in West Virginia as the coal industry continues kind of a death spiral and the communities here are making a historic transition away from some of these heavy industries. So our story kind of points out the unique place of Institute in all of this and how some of the activists like Pam Nixon, longtime Institute resident, were working very hard at lobbying and speaking at rallies trying to get Senator Manchin to support this legislation. And now they feel very let down that he has declined to do that.
And do they think his ties to the fossil fuel industry, his monetary investments with the industry, had something to do with it?
Well, I think the most interesting thing about Senator Manchin and his family's connections to the mining industry are that they cut both ways. Yes, his family continues to make significant amounts of money from its connections with the coal mining industry. At the same time, Senator Manchin lost an uncle in 1968 in the Farmington mine disaster, an explosion that killed a bunch of coal miners. And so Senator Manchin's family knows, like West Virginia, the relationship there is both enriching, but also tragic.
Evan, I noticed rereading your profile in The New Yorker on Manchin, and you wrote that Manchin's, quote, belief that Democrats could and must find Republican support for their legislation is a posture, quote, so at odds with the present hostilities in Washington that it evoked a man hoisting his glass for a toast while his guests lunged at one another with steak knives. Evan, is Manchin just full of it when it comes to his, like, stated commitment to bipartisanship, or is he naive?
I think the thing to remember is that very often a politician acquires the habits of mind that shaped them when they were coming up, when they were successful. And this applies to Joe Biden as much as Joe Manchin. These are guys who came up at a time when you could muscle people towards a consensus. You could, by some combination of charm and coercion, you could get people to agree on stuff, Republicans and Democrats. And he came to Washington kind of with the same idea. No, he's not faking it when he says that he thinks that he can get people to agree. But I think there is a feeling in Washington that he's operating in a realm in which there is this aspirational goal of getting everybody around the table. And the truth is, that's not at the moment something that's leading to resolution because of the toxicity of the divisions in Washington. And that leaves him sort of on an island of his own.
I've been speaking with Evan Osnos, staff writer for The New Yorker and contributor to CNN, and Ken Ward Jr., co-founder of Mountain State Spotlight and distinguished local reporting fellow with ProPublica. Thank you guys for coming on The Takeaway. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
By the end of 2014, in the final years of the Obama administration, President Obama declared America's ground war against ISIS essentially done. Instead, the administration traded boots on the ground for aircraft and precision bombs that could be directed by controllers sitting at computers, often thousands of miles away. But an extraordinary New York Times investigation published over the weekend found that many of those airstrikes were often imprecise. The Times obtained more than 1,300 reports of civilian casualties from a hidden Pentagon archive of airstrikes in Iraq and Syria between September 2014 and January 2018. Many of these casualties were not previously made public and show how flawed intelligence and rush targeting led to thousands of civilian deaths, many of them children. The Times analysis also found hundreds of more civilian deaths had gone uncounted and were not included in the Pentagon documents. Asmat Khan, an investigative reporter at the New York Times Magazine, has spent the past 5 years traveling through Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan, investigating the aftermath of air campaigns and speaking with survivors. Welcome to the show, Asmat.
Thank you for having me.
Can you start by just giving us an overview of how these operations work? Where does the intelligence come from to locate the targets? How are the bombs deployed? Where are the American soldiers situated when they're running these operations?
Right. So the intelligence can really come from one of two different ways. One is it's pre-planned. they've been informed of a target, something that is important, but not necessarily extremely urgent. So they have the time to kind of vet it. And those are known as deliberate strikes. They're run through a pretty rigorous vetting process. And then the other kind of airstrike that happens is a dynamic strike. It is sometimes known as there's a target of opportunity or quicksilver intelligence that appears or an imminent threat. And that doesn't go through as many levels of vetting, but it is still vetted on some level. And, you know, because there are these two different kinds, they can be executed in very different ways. And usually the latter category is based on some kind of an imminent threat to friendly forces, right? With few Americans on the ground, we're generally talking about our Iraqi or Syrian Defense Forces partners who maybe are facing some kind of a threat. And you might see it, right? You might see it in footage and it's developed quite quickly while watching the scene of the battle. Or like a deliberate strike, it might be something that comes to you, whether that's through a tip on the ground, whether that is something that you're observing and you start to see a pattern over time, and then you make the decision, or at least this coalition led by the United States in Iraq and Syria makes a decision based on many different kinds of intelligence that they might be taking in.
And they make a decision, and then who is actually dropping the bomb? Who is firing these weapons?
So it depends. Most of the time, it's the United States that is physically, you know, that's operating the aircraft and is dropping the bomb. Sometimes the United States will do the vetting and will be involved in that pre-planning, and it might be a U.S. partner in that coalition. So, for example, the Netherlands that actually does the dropping or maybe flying the aircraft on a particular occasion. But the overwhelming majority are both planned and conducted by the United States. On occasion, some of our partners would be the ones doing that. But almost every single strike is involved with U.S. leaders in some different capacity.
And what about drones? Are there also drones that are dropping these weapons?
Sometimes. I think that there's a sort of prevailing belief that these kinds of strikes today are carried out by drones all of the time. Drones, I think they're certainly used for surveillance purposes. They can be equipped with weapons and used for the purposes of firing. But sometimes there are aircraft that have been in our arsenal for quite a while, like the B-52, different kinds of aircraft, you know, the kind of aircraft that we've used in the past that maybe people don't associate with U.S. air power today because of the rise of the idea of the drone.
Mm. You know, it's amazing how imprecise so many of these strikes are, even though we were promised that they were precision operations. You write that, quote, an adult male associated with ISIS was actually an elderly female. A man with a weapon on his left shoulder actually had no weapon. A heavy object being dragged into a building was, in fact, a child. Why was the military so often wrong?
This is a problem of what in the military they call misidentification or conflating somebody who is a civilian as an enemy. And a lot of times, as I think people kind of watched unfold during the Kabul airstrike earlier this year, the leading reason is confirmation bias. So when you're told that you should vet this target, right, that this is a weapons factory, you tend to start to see everything around it as associated with that. So all of a sudden, this elderly woman may look like an ISIS fighter because that's who you anticipate to be around that facility. Or a man who might be holding a shovel may look to them like he's holding an RPG. And these are often seen as through that prism. You know, there are individuals who were watching footage and saw civilians, and it was easily recognizable to some of the reviewers after the fact that those were civilians, but it's not apparent that the people watching in real time knew that this group of people gathered on the sidewalk was civilians because they were so convinced that the car, what they believed was a car bomb that they had been tracking was a car bomb, that they could not reconcile the idea that this car would stop and talk to individuals who were civilians. So they were kind of still convinced that those were enemies. That happens, you know, a great deal when people are watching just through this footage and they don't really have a sense of what reality is like on the ground.
Can you give us a little idea about how you gathered all this information, what the process was like?
Yes. So this has been an intense process over many years, but it really began in 2016 as the war against ISIS was being fought, as territory was being retaken. And I found myself watching these numbers roll out from the US military about how many thousands, tens of thousands of ISIS fighters they were claiming to have killed. And yet at the time, they were only admitting maybe not even two dozen civilian deaths. And those numbers just didn't add up to me. I had recently finished an investigation analyzing or looking at US-funded schools in Afghanistan and claims around those, where I'd done a ground sample. And I thought, well, could I do something similar, right? You know, I just returned from a different war zone where I'd seen an incredible divergence between what the US military and US leaders had claimed about their successes in that war, and then what happened when I did a ground sample and I went looking at those schools. So I thought, can I do this with airstrikes? And I began in Iraq in a town called Kayara. And I think on my very first trip, you know, what I found, you know, in going to 10 airstrikes that first time I went, five of them involved civilian casualties, which was a rate that was so different than what the military had been claiming. And so I spent the next 2 years almost expanding a sample, you know, really coming back again and again to Iraq to basically look at a sample of 103 airstrikes, both those that resulted in civilian casualties and those that didn't. And what my co-author at the time and I concluded was that 1 in 5 of these airstrikes, these coalition airstrikes in Iraq, had resulted in a civilian death, which was 31 times higher than what the government was claiming at the time. But the problem with that kind of analysis for me was that, you know, I didn't really have a lot of clarity on what the government was necessarily targeting, you know, what their intelligence was. And in the case of a sort of main character in that story at the time, it was called The Uncounted, and it was also in the New York Times Magazine, I was able to obtain through the Freedom of Information Act, you know, the record of what they assessed in this man whose name is Bassem Razdo's case, who lost his wife, his daughter, his brother, and his nephew. And it was just a document that was filled with assessments of confirmation bias, where essentially almost everything this family did, from opening the gates. And because of that, you know, I just really wanted to know how often this happens, what these other assessments for not pre-planned strikes, for these dynamic strikes looked like when there was even less time to vet a target. And I started filing more requests and I obtained more than 1,300 of them and analyzed them. And then in addition to sort of looking at the trends within them, you know, as I just mentioned, a military document can only tell you so much. Right. I knew I needed to try to visit as many of these cases, these documents that I had, and look at them on the ground to try to compare. And that's where a lot of the trends that we've been talking about really came out.
And you spoke to victims and people who lost loved ones and documented their stories in these articles, right?
Yeah, that's a crucial part of my process. And unfortunately, it is not a part of the military's process when they're assessing civilian casualties. So, you know, I would interview people on the ground, survivors, loved ones, relatives, people who wanted to share their stories. I would do everything I could to verify and fact check, you know, what people told me, whether that was analyzing dates and satellite imagery, whether it was interviewing many others who lived in the area to figure out where ISIS had functioned, you know, if there was an ISIS target that was nearby, all different kinds of things to really put that in context. I know that there are, you know, I often get asked these questions like, well, how do you know that they're not lying to you? Or how do you know that they weren't ISIS? And I have to meet a very high level to show that in my work. But one thing that frustrates me is that I don't think our military has been held to that same standard when they claim to have intelligence that essentially authorizes someone's death, their targeting. That often remains classified. And that's part of why getting these documents has been such an effort over many years. It really took a while to do this, along with help from many others, including the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, which represented me in my lawsuit against the Department of Defense, which really didn't want to give up these records, and certainly not in their totality. And that tells you a great deal about what kinds of transparency the military offers us, and the kind of sources they even take in to try to vet and trust, to understand, you know, the impacts of their own operations.
We've got just a few seconds left, but I was wondering if, since your bombshell reporting came out, have you heard from officials in the Obama or Trump administrations expressing any regrets? Are there national security officials in the Biden administration who are pledging to somehow improve or even curtail these operations going forward? Any significant reaction from the government?
That's a good question. I do know that, you know, parts of the military had been in the process of developing a new civilian casualty policy, actually as a result of that article that I mentioned earlier, The Uncounted, from several years ago, and that, you know, they were intending to bring that policy, to make that policy public in the near future. And I don't know what is happening with that. I have not heard much, to be honest with you, from U.S. officials the way I have in the past, immediately after some of these things. I think this is so recent. It came out on a weekend, and, you know, it's almost before the holidays. So I'm not sure what more I'll be hearing, but I think people, it was a vast amount of information to take in. And to be really honest with you, even in the procurement of these records, it took the DOD a long time to get all of them, right? They were stored in all of these different places to even provide them to my lawyers. My sense is probably that they're probably trying to recall all the records right now themselves.
Asmat Khan is an investigative reporter at the New York Times Magazine. Asmat, thank you so much for this incredible piece of journalism and for talking about it with us on The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
The 19th century was a time of great innovation, and to marvel at all the latest creations, countries across the globe used to gather at the world's fairs. It was there where we first saw the Eiffel Tower, the Ferris wheel, the television and telephone, and where we ate our first ice cream cone. That tradition continues in Dubai right now, but its legacy may not actually be tied to what the public will see unveiled next, but what's laid bare behind the scenes. The World's Fair in Dubai, known as Expo 2020, has employed migrant workers to build it out, and many are claiming they were tricked into coming to the city for unlivable wages after paying an illegal fee to local recruiters. Some workers even reported having their passports confiscated, leaving them stranded in a foreign country. For more on the human rights issues plaguing Expo 2020 in Dubai, I spoke with Isabel Debray, Gulf and Iran correspondent for the Associated Press. I started off by asking Isabel, what exactly is Expo 2020?
Over the past century, people have gone crazy for the World's Fair. You know, that's where ketchup was invented. That's where the Eiffel Tower was unveiled. It was a huge event that meant so much to the world. And in the past, you know, maybe decade or so, people have kind of started caring less about the World Expo. But it's still around, still chugging along, and it's at a different country every few years. And Dubai won the World Expo bid 8 years ago. And it was this huge deal for the city that was, you know, trying to put itself on the world stage. And it's this massive event. Dubai built this sprawling exhibition center in the middle of the desert outside of the city. And it invited, you know, over 190 countries to participate. They all have their own pavilions and you can go inside, and each country is trying to basically pitch you the best things about it. And it's kind of like a massive, you know, fairground experience, but educational and historical.
Constructing this project is obviously a massive ordeal. So tell me about the workers who have been creating it, who have been constructing it. You found that many were forced to survive through inhumane practices. Could you elaborate on what these workers are going through?
as you mentioned, it's this massive undertaking, and it's this massive chance for Dubai to sort of put itself on the world stage. And just because it is the UAE, it also, the Dubai Expo sort of dealt with the same labor system that the UAE deals with. And it's called the Kafala Labor Sponsorship System. And it basically works by tying the worker's residency or their visa to their job. So it basically gives employers this kind of outsized amount of power where absconding, they call it absconding, but basically leaving the job or changing employers is not allowed. That is, you know, you can basically land in prison or be fined or deported for doing that. You're not allowed to unionize. That's also against the law. And in many cases, you know, there's no minimum wage, and you're obliged to live in these sorts of dormitories or these kind of housing where, you know, housing is provided, but you kind of have no say over your personal space, your privacy. You live often with, sometimes it's just 4 to 6, sometimes up to 10 people kind of crammed into one room. And so this is the system that prevails in the UAE and actually across the Persian Gulf. And this is what workers were facing here at Expo.
And there were thousands of workers, I guess at the height of construction?
Yes, there were tens of thousands of workers over the course of construction. Yes, and obviously it took many years. And we saw that over different periods of time, you know, the conditions differed. And we spoke to researchers that were really documenting the situation during the coronavirus pandemic and when it hit, and found that the conditions in these dormitories were, you know, it was very crowded. It was unsafe. You had 80 people at one point sharing a single toilet. You know, you had people who were basically terminated without notice, deprived of months of wages. And that was happening during the pandemic. So that was over the course of the year. But, you know, also some of these sort of similar conditions did also occur even as the fair opened in the past few months.
Could you zoom out a little bit? Labor issues and worker abuses when it comes to migrant workers, that's not a new issue for the Gulf, right? Can you give a little bit of context here about how Dubai has been built and the way migrant workers have been used in these construction projects?
This is not new. And I think it's become, you know, just more contentious over the years. But the system really emerged in the 1950s as, you know, oil was booming and these countries were making lots of money, the Persian Gulf. And economies were developing fast. Dubai was, you know, just needed, like all the rest of the countries in the Gulf, needed to import foreign cheap labor. And the way to do that was, you know, from Africa and Southeast Asia. They don't have a population here that would be able to sustain that. It's a very small local population. And so they imported, you know, ultimately millions of workers that, again, needed the jobs to you know, lift their own families out of poverty. And so we're happy for these positions in the Gulf. And yeah, that's how these societies were built. Basically, from the desert, you have Dubai, this massive, you know, skyscrapers, futuristic skyline that was built by laborers who came here from their own countries across Africa and Asia and other countries in the Middle East. So this is definitely not new. But I think what we're seeing, at least in the past decade, is these government mega projects are only becoming more frequent, especially with massive events that the world cares about, like whether that's the World Cup in Qatar that's coming up next year. You have Formula One in Saudi Arabia for the first time this year. You have obviously Expo. And these are big world events that the world, you know, people care about. They're sending their citizens to visit, that boost the brand of the home country. It makes them look tolerant and cosmopolitan. And that's, you know, really wonderful for these countries. But it also does bring scrutiny. And so we're seeing, okay, you know, great that you have these beautiful, you know, exhibits and this, you know, these fairgrounds, but who built it and what were their conditions and what rights did they have? And those questions, I think, are increasingly being asked.
And these are migrant workers recruited from their home countries, right? Where are they from and how does that system work?
These people people are from, you know, typically quite poor countries, mostly Africa, Southeast Asia, a lot from India and Pakistan. And what happens is, I mean, there's a reason why these people are so desperate to work in Dubai, to go abroad. They're from, you know, they come from poverty, they're in very desperate conditions. And often, you know, people I've spoken to have kind of described the system where, you know, whether it's the village in Ghana or in Fiji, wherever it is, people are whispering about sort of the promise of Dubai and the excitement, the money you could make, the money you could send home, and, you know, remittances, the money that workers do send home to powers economies. It lifts families out of poverty. It's a huge deal for these countries like the Philippines.
Sure.
And so that's what, you know, they're sent. Sometimes they've never been outside of their country and they're sort of plopped into in these fairgrounds in Dubai or, you know, wherever they work in the Gulf. But in the case of Expo, yeah, they're sometimes on Expo specific contracts. Sometimes they just are sent to Dubai and then the massive company based in Dubai or Abu Dhabi then sends them to Expo.
How much are these workers getting paid?
I mean, I spoke to many cleaners that were not getting more than $190 a month.
And your reporting also indicated that some of these workers had their passports or IDs taken by their employers. So therefore, it wasn't like they could leave the job or find a different job or go home necessarily, right?
Exactly. And this is something that does happen across Dubai, the UAE, the entire region, that passport confiscation is a tactic that employers use to basically keep their employers, their employees. And it deprives people of their ability to leave, their ability to even go to the bank, to do anything if they do want to have, you know, access to that and they're not able to. So right. it's a huge issue.
Isabel Dubray is the Associated Press's Gulf and Iran correspondent. Isabel, thanks so much for coming on and explaining all these issues related to the Expo. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
Amber Ruffin has been a Black writer in mostly white spaces for much of her career. But her success has led to opportunities to make her own spaces and make them as Black as she wants.
Nothing feels better than being like, which Babyface song? Not that one, the other one. It's the feeling of writing without weights.
I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America for a conversation with comedian Amber Ruffin. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Me.
We all know that you shouldn't count your chickens before they hatch. You should also not count your enormous, super powerful, 7-ton, $10 billion telescopes before they're launched and unfurled into space. The James Webb Space Telescope, an observatory that will allow us to look deeper into space and further back in time than we ever have, is supposed to launch on December 24th. The date was pushed back from the original launch date of December 22nd, which actually was supposed to launch way back in 2007, but there have been numerous setbacks over the last 14 years that have all of us at the edge of our seats wondering if this telescope is ever going to leave the ground. And others might be wondering, why are we even bothering to spend all of that money on a big old mirror in space when we should be reflecting on all of the unresolved issues right here on planet Earth? Here to talk to us about the final frontier and why space exploration matters is freelance science journalist Shannon Sterone. She's written for the New York Times, The Atlantic, and everywhere else around the galaxy. Hi there, Shannon. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell us why the James Webb Space Telescope launch is such a big deal.
Yeah, the JWST.
JWST.
For short.
Yes. Okay, I'll say that
NASA loves their acronyms. It is the biggest, most powerful telescope we've built and hopefully sent to space, we'll send to space. It's going to be able to look at the universe the way we've never seen before, and that's using infrared light. So it's going to give us views into the earliest galaxies, 13 billion years old. It's essentially like having invisible goggles. It'll allow us to see what we can't see.
Wow. Can you explain more about why we can see older galaxies using this? Can you explain what that means?
Yeah. So Hubble, which we know, you know, has given us incredible scientific discoveries, some of the most beautiful pictures you could ever imagine, sees in visible light and in ultraviolet light. But the JWST telescope sees in infrared, which means that it can see through matter. So the one way to think about it is as our universe ages and expands, that light from the oldest galaxies gets really stretched out. And infrared light stretches. It's one of the longest wavelengths. So JWST can see in that wavelength. It'll essentially allow us to see through matter. So what Hubble would be able to see, you know, look at this gorgeous planet, look at this gorgeous galaxy, JWST will be able to see through all of that matter to things that we've not literally ever been able to see before.
That's nuts. That's so exciting. Of course, this thing has to get into space. Can you explain what the deal is with the mirror?
Yeah, the mirror. God, it makes me nervous and raises my blood pressure just thinking about it. So this behemoth of a telescope, its mirror is enormous. And because it's really difficult to launch such a huge telescope off of Earth, we have to put it inside of the top of a rocket fairing, which means it has to get smushed and condensed. And what that means is folding up these gold-plated, highly sensitive mirrors and then launching it into space. And then it has to unfurl like a large $10 billion umbrella. And we know how well umbrellas work generally,
right,
let alone with a telescope. So once we get it out to the, it's called L2, Lagrange point 2, it will unfurl, and hopefully it will unfurl. This is the thing that's making all of us nervous.
Sure. And you need that mirror because of the sun, right? That's the point of the mirror?
Yeah. So the cold part of the mirror is going to be facing out to the rest of space. And then the back of it essentially serves as a giant sun shield. So where it's going to be parked out, it's sort of lined up with the Earth and the sun, and the back of it will block the light from the sun, which will keep it, you know, a good temperature, and will also allow it to just not have any interference while it does its observations.
What do we hope we might learn from the images that this telescope gathers, assuming it makes it up there? New planets, black holes, what are we going to find out?
Hopefully all of those things. I think getting a view at the oldest galaxies, being able to see farther back into the history of our universe than we've ever seen before, can give us more answers and more context for how our universe came to be. What happened after the Big Bang? You know, we generally know a lot of those answers, but there's gaps in the storyline, and JWST is really our next big hope for filling in those gaps. And by understanding how old the universe is, what happened, what are those galaxies like that were first created, it'll help us understand how do galaxies form and why does our galaxy look like it does and Andromeda looks like it does. And it fills in the story, and we're missing so much of it. So it's really important.
Is there a specific thing you'd want to know that maybe it could tell you? I mean, something about black holes and what's going on over there. I mean, is there something specifically that you can't wait to find out that this telescope might hold the answers to?
It's possible that JWST could detect life. And, you know, by being able to look throughout the universe in infrared light, it allows us to see heat signatures, to see how far light is stretched, which means that when something is that sensitive, there could be anomalies or things that it detects that alert us to possible life in the universe. And I think that's the most exciting thing.
You know, a cynic might ask, you know, not me, but a cynic, how can we justify spending all of this money on space exploration, particularly space exploration that might not even pan out? We don't even know if this thing will get up there, when we have so many unresolved issues here on Earth.
I think one thing it's really important to note that, yes, $10 billion for a telescope objectively seems like a lot of money. That is a lot of money. But NASA, who's paying for the telescope, only gets less than 1/2 of 1% of the entire federal budget. it's really, I mean, not, you don't even pay half of a penny out of your tax dollars to fund NASA. It's like a crumb of funding. So in that sense, it's really not that much money. But the truth is that we can do both. It's really about what we value, how we allocate resources here on Earth. We know that we're not really great at doing that in general, mm-hmm. but space exploration really is an opportunity for us to learn how we're connected to each other. And, you know, we do that by sending spacecraft out to other planets, by launching telescopes like JWST, by looking at, you know, using Hubble to observe the cosmos, by giving us context and a story for how we came into existence, how we exist in the context of things, is a tremendous gift. And it's incredibly human to want to explore space, to want to look up and ask these questions. And I think that if we are not doing that in tandem with taking care of things properly on Earth, then we're robbing ourselves of a truly human experience.
That's beautifully put. Is there anything that we can learn about life on Earth, anything tangible that we can learn to help human beings by exploring space?
Oh, absolutely. NASA, I mean, in terms of climate change and climate monitoring, its satellites are responsible for most of our understanding of climate change. So that's one facet of it. I think that the pale blue dot is a great example of that. The famous image taken by the Voyager 1 spacecraft on Valentine's Day in 1990. And yesterday was the 25th anniversary of Carl Sagan's death. So we're all discussing it, but just a photograph. If we used one example and not even use the science, but just one image of the spacecraft looking back at the our solar system from billions of miles away and snapping a picture of Earth as a mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam. If that does not make you think about your neighbors and your family and our environment and sort of how we exist here with each other, then I don't know what will. We are truly here together. And I think that that's the biggest gift, even more than the science, than anything from space exploration, is reminding us we're here together. How incredible it is that we get to know that we get to travel far out into space and look back and give ourselves this gift of reflection and go, wow, that's us. That's all of us too. It's not just me. It's all of us.
That was so eloquently put, Shannon, and I think is an important perspective for us to consider at this moment, considering all the challenges here on Earth. Thank you so much for joining us on The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
That, of course, was one of the many musical numbers from the hit 1992 movie Sister Act. Sister Act stars Whoopi Goldberg as Dolores Wilson, a lounge singer placed in a convent as part of the Witness Protection Program after witnessing a murder. At the convent, she ultimately takes over the choir, infusing traditional hymns with gospel and rock and roll vibes. Sister Act is far from the first or last movie about nuns. From horror films like 2018's The Nun to the nunsploitation films of the 70s, Hollywood has a habit, of depicting the lives of nuns on the big screen. For more on this, I spoke with Alyssa Wilkinson, film critic and culture reporter at Vox, and I asked her why we're so obsessed with nuns, pop culturally speaking.
You can kind of look way back in film history and see movies about nuns being very popular. You could think of Black Narcissus in 1947, or of course The Sound of Music in 1965, right? But recently there's been a peak of those. And I think some of that is due to the sort of other nature of the life in a convent, right? It feels almost like aspirational in some ways, where it's a quiet place, it's a closed off place, it's a place full of women who are mainly interacting with one another without a huge need to interact with men. Certainly in history, that's been the appeal. And telling historical stories or present day stories about nuns gives us a whole different setting in which to explore all kinds of genres: horror, drama, comedy, sometimes raunchy comedy, really, you know, meaningful and contemplative dramas. All of that takes place really beautifully in a convent and gives us a new way to look at those stories.
Could you click off some of the classic pop cultural content focused on nuns through the years? I mean, you mentioned Sound of Music, but what are some of the others that we all know?
Sure. So, you know, as I said, the Black Narcissus, the 1947 Paul and Pressburger movie, is really kind of wonderful if you've never seen it. I just rewatched it. I couldn't believe how prescient it felt. And that one's been remade a couple of times. Has some really incredible, like, sort of effects that are circa 1947. But horror has always been kind of interested in nuns as well. You know, the Devils, Ken Russell's movie is one that people talk about a lot. Even recently, horror has been really interested in nuns. Some people might remember that just a few years ago, The Conjuring did a movie called The Nun that was in their universe. So that's very much there. And then there's also a lot of kind of, there was a whole genre of nunsploitation in the 70s, and which is kind of exactly what it sounds like. It was movies that, you know, often were very interested in sexuality and also in kind of, revolting against the male-driven hierarchy of the church. Those did pop up in Europe a lot, but in Japan as well, where Catholicism never was the dominant religion, but people kind of read those as a way to react against, you know, a would-be colonizing force. So this has been true for many years, but there definitely is a discernible uptick, I would say, in the last 10 years or so, partly just because there's so much rich possibility within the convent.
Sure. What kind of power do nuns wield, as you write in your Vox piece? Are they inherently threatening to male authority?
Well, so it's interesting, right? So within the, I should say off the top, I'm not personally Catholic, but I certainly have spent a lot of time with people who are vocationally Catholic. And, you know, an interesting thing about nuns is that they are sort of self-governing, right, within the convent. There's a lot of richness to the life there, and there's a hierarchy there, and submitting to one another and deciding how their days are going to go and what kind of work they're going to do. But they're still in the kind of male hierarchy of the church. And certainly in Catholicism, you know, the bishops and the priests and the Pope are all men. And so there's this interesting tension that I think is attractive to a lot of filmmakers. You know, whether or not the representation of it is based in reality is certainly a question for the women themselves to answer, but there's certainly an appeal to that tension between here are women who are religious, who are leading religious services amongst themselves, who are performing religious duties and have a certain amount of power, and yet they still can't, you know, perform the sacraments. And so there's an interesting tension there to be explored.
What about the more recent movies that have come out? What is the film Benedetta about, and how do nuns factor in there?
Benedetta is very much a nunsploitation movie, sort of latter day.
Okay.
It's Paul Verhoeven who, you know, gave us Showgirls and RoboCop and movies like that. So you would kind of expect that from him. He actually has a long running interest in religious life and in Jesus. He was part of the Jesus Seminar and has written a book about Jesus. And so Benedetta actually takes, I think, some of his ideas about Jesus, about maybe not being supernatural, but being able to kind of use the system to rebel against prevailing authorities. And he places this in the world of a 17th century nun who really did exist, Benedetta Carlini. Mm-hmm. And she joined a convent. She became an abbess and a mystic and kind of an outcast. Rome was not pleased with her. And she was also notorious for having this relationship with a younger nun, Bartolomea, who is also in the film. And so the film is really about confronting authority. It's also, you know, very obviously provocative and certainly would be offensive to some people. But it is also very funny. And if you're into Paul Verhoeven, it's the kind of movie that he was sort of born to make.
Tell me about the book Matrix by Lauren Groff, which has gotten a lot of buzz recently.
Yeah, terrific, terrific novel. Lauren Groff writes these incredible novels. This is not at all related to the Matrix movies. I should make this very clear. instead, it's about another real woman, Marie de France, who was a 12th century nun. We don't know a ton about her, but what we know about her, we know through her poetry, and we know certain things about her life. She was a prioress at an abbey, and she's a medieval woman who Lauren Groff imagines as this revolutionary. She was able to take a convent that was basically in disrepair and everyone was dying in it and turn it into this force for they grew their own food. They eventually built a maze around the convent and they became very, very troublesome to the authorities. And she sort of renders this through Marie's eyes. So it's quite an incredible book to read. And the writing is really, really great, but it's also this picture of almost kind of radical separatist nuns in the 12th century, which is wild to read and kind of reminds us that this tension has always been there.
Alyssa Wilkinson is a film critic and senior culture reporter at Vox. Really appreciate you coming on The Takeaway.
Thank you.
That's all we have for you folks today. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'll be with you guys all week, so come back tomorrow. Call us with your show ideas and your suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Matt Katz, in for Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.